From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. is the country with the most confirmed cases of COVID-19, and we've been paying a lot of attention to the largest U.S. city, New York, where more than 1,300 people have died.
The nation's second largest city, Los Angeles, is hoping to avoid New York's fate. And the mayor, Eric Garcetti, is now asking residents to wear masks when out in public. Not the N95 surgical masks that healthcare workers need, but makeshift masks. Mayor Garcetti joins us now from Los Angeles. Mayor, thanks for taking a few minutes for us.
You bet. Good to be with you, Jeremy. Thanks.
And what made you make this request of everyone in Los Angeles?
Well, I wanted to do this for a few days, just looking at countries that have had slower spread in places like Taiwan and places like the Czech Republic, places often where there's a culture because they've gone through epidemics before. And while it's clear that we need to protect the N95 masks, and I want to be very clear, people should not be either hoarding those or buying them and taking them away from our medical professionals. There's no question that when people go out to the grocery store, to protect our frontline workers there as clerks, when we're at pharmacies, and even when we're out on the street, that research shows that in varying degrees, even something like a bandana, as long as it's tucked in, all the way up to the non-medical grade masks that are not quite makeshift, they're designed and they're supposed to be for this, can help stop the spread of droplets. And while we know that the COVID A virus is smaller than many of the pores in masks. I think the metaphor we've all been using is a football player might be able to get through that doorway, but when there's five or six trying to get through, even a larger space can help, and anything that can help right now will save lives.
Have you considered enforcing either the masks or the stay-at-home order?
Well, we're certainly enforcing stay-at-home. We've visited over 540 businesses with our ambassadors program, with police where necessary, and we've even referred eight for criminal charges, a smoke shop that just ignores the police, and we're shutting down the water and power of businesses that refuse to abide by the stay-at-home order. But no, with the masks right now, we want to educate people, give folks a chance to get them, and because Los Angeles is an apparel manufacturing center of America, we're working with hundreds of companies locally who have sewers and sewing machines. We've come up with good designs, and they are creating these masks, as well as a larger project called LA Protects, in which 3D printers and architects and some of our manufacturing assembly lines are being retooled for other protective equipment for medical personnel, frontline workers, first responders, and others.
Let's talk about testing. We're seeing California lag other states. Data from the COVID tracking project earlier this week shows that New York, Louisiana, and Washington State are all doing five times the amount of tests per capita as California is. How soon do you think California can ramp up the testing to those levels?
It's a hugely frustrating thing for all of us, Jeremy. And, you know, it's interesting, as a local official, there's really nobody who's quote-unquote in charge of testing, right? You go to counties who often take care of healthcare and have public hospitals, but they don't take care of private hospitals and nonprofit ones. Cities generally don't have health departments. But I kind of took the bull by the horn, so at least in the city of L.A., for now, almost 2 weeks now, we've been doing testing that our firefighters are staffing. People can drive up. We have now eight of these sites. Per capita, we're about one out of every 200 people by probably the end of today in the city will have been tested. We're having to find the labs, find the tests, find the swabs, find the equipment, find the personnel, and set these things up. I'm very proud of what we've done in the city of L.A., but I think you're right. You look up and down California, a huge state, and many places don't have those resources, might not have their own fire department. Medical personnel are already stretched thin. This is one of those moments when we really do need national leadership. And to say that everybody who wants a test can have one obviously has not been the truth for weeks. But now we're meeting capacity, and each day, the number of people that sign up online and get those tests is growing. We've doubled it every single week for the last couple of weeks, and we hope to double it again next week.
I want to ask you about one more thing, and that's the homeless population. There are some 60,000 homeless people in your city. What are your concerns when it comes to protecting the homeless from coronavirus?
Well, this is a huge concern for me. LA County, right, has about 60,000. We have a little bit over 30,000 in the city here. And about in late January, I asked my team to start planning because these were going to be the most susceptible and vulnerable people when it came to this virus. Susceptible because they're out there on the streets, and vulnerable because they already have many times underlying medical conditions that can make them more likely to die from this.
Right.
So we have a historic a number of shelters that we have opened up. We make sure people's temperature are taken before. We've opened up 13. 13 more will be opened in the next four or 5 days. And thousands of hotel and motel rooms that we are now in the process of securing, over 1,000 of them already as we speak, where people with symptoms can be put. We have trailers also, over 500 of them, travel trailers, where people who are in any of the congregate shelters that are properly spaced but nevertheless have symptoms can immediately be put someplace and be isolated.
That is Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck.
Thank you. Strength and love to you.
Well, meanwhile, like President Trump, Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp has reversed his earlier relaxed views on the coronavirus and imposed a statewide stay-at-home order effective midnight tonight. 150 people have died in Georgia, and there's concern there about the homeless. When Atlanta resident Terrence Lester first heard about COVID-19 and the hand-washing directive, he thought, well, how are they going to do that? As a teenager, he lived for a while on the streets. A friend's father extended a hand to him and said, you will be a leader someday. And Terrence is. He's founder of the Love Beyond Walls nonprofit that serves the homeless. And now with donations, including from Grammy-winning gospel hip-hop artist Lecrae, he's delivered hand-washing stations to the homeless around Atlanta. Terrence, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and let's start by describing the problem. It would seem, you know, we get it. Oh, right. How are the homeless washing their hands? But you remind us everything's closed.
Yeah. The impact of the coronavirus has shut down businesses, restaurants, public spaces. Many people experiencing homelessness frequent communities of faith, which have closed. You think about libraries have also been closed. And there are a number of places that probably would also not prohibit someone experiencing homelessness to enter into their facility. And so we started hearing things like, I'm afraid that I'll contract the coronavirus because I have nowhere to wash my hands.
Right. Well, so you have come up with these portable sinks. Now, we'll post pictures at herenow.org, but they look like stand-up vacuum cleaners, if people can picture that. They've got a base, kind of a foot pedal, and then there's a nozzle that goes up to this small sink with a very thin faucet at the top. I understand these are something people might get if they have an RV or go camping.
That's exactly it. Our organization years ago started receiving RV units to temporarily house people to help them transition out of homelessness. And the idea just came about, why don't we repurpose this and literally use this for a community of people who are always outside and without shelter.
So you stand at the base, and with your feet, you pump the base, and it pumps the water up the nozzle, out the faucet at the top. It is genius.
Yeah. And then there's a drain as well that allows the gray water to run away from where the person is standing.
Right.
And it also has a soap dispenser. There's public health research right now that suggests that if we're asking the community to wash your hands to protect against the spread and contraction of the coronavirus, then we also need to provide tools for the parts of the community to perform those behaviors if they're experiencing homelessness.
The container holds from 5 to 10 gallons. So you've got volunteers from your group who are willing to go out, change the water, put more soap in. Are you worried that you might actually be spreading some infection by having something out there that, you know, may get the virus on it, meaning people who are holding the basin of this? But then as soon as I ask it, I'm thinking, well, you know, the homeless who desperately need to wash their hands, I think would still be better off with this portable sink.
Yeah. One of the practices that we have is to sanitize the stations daily, a few times a day. But then I think about stories like Run, who there was a group out providing meals because commuters are quarantined, and most times people experiencing homelessness rely on the community of people going back and forth to work. And this guy who was about to run over to get in line to get a meal turned around and walked over to the sink and looked at us and said, I'm glad I can wash my hands before I eat.
Well, I mean, it's such a lovely gesture for them, but it also keeps other people safer, keeps everyone safer.
That's right. And I think this moment is showing us that we need to be about the entire community, the whole community, even those who are houseless. They're someone's aunt, someone's mother, father, cousin, sister, brother.
At the George Terrence Joyce Lester Jazz and Heritage Center, streamed by WWOZ in New Orleans.
He's putting portable sinks around Atlanta. It's soon going to be expanding to other American cities who've shown an interest in this so that the homeless can wash their hands. Terrence, there's something really spiritual in this, you know, the whole we're coming into Easter and the whole, you know, biblical thought of washing someone's feet. This is a lovely thing you're doing.
And for me, in the ways of Jesus mentioning Easter, you know, I just want to show that compassion to my neighbor.
Thanks, and best of luck to you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
These are especially difficult and scary times for immigrant communities, especially because many don't speak or read English as a first language. So it's very hard to get factual information about the coronavirus. So many of these communities are turning more and more to social media. Monica Samayoa of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
Voss Workers' Rights Education Project focuses on empowering immigrants in Portland to improve their working conditions. But the nonprofit has seen a steady decline in employment opportunities due to COVID-19. Executive Director Osmani Alcaraz Ochoa says those who are largely affected are non-English speaking and elderly.
We have a population that has historically had a lot of social barriers.
He says work for day laborers rises in the spring, but because of the COVID-19 pandemic, jobs are drying up. As the seriousness of the virus has progressed, staff at Voss and places that serve other immigrant communities throughout Oregon have taken it upon themselves to educate and inform their communities about resources and about COVID-19.
We're scrambling to ensure that our members have the education they need about what's happening. They have individual and collective kind of like preparedness planning, and then also basic access to basic needs.
Many non-English speaking immigrants in Oregon have been resorting to social media as their primary source of information. Reina Lopez is executive director of the Farm Worker and Tree Planter Union, Pineros and Campesinos Unidos de Noroeste. She says the mostly non-English speaking Latinos her groups work with are relying on platforms like Facebook to translate and share news within their communities.
Our digital posts on Facebook have been, and the ones in Spanish have been the ones that gotten the most clicks, the most shares, the most engagements on those posts.
But Lopez says finding trustworthy sources and getting news translated in a timely manner is a big challenge. Other immigrant organizations have figured out a way to get news and share it in a timely manner. Juana Lay is a community organizer for the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. She says the Chinese American community is mainly getting its information from WeChat, a Chinese social media app that offers multi-purpose messaging and has an estimated 1 billion users.
All the Chinese, we use the social media called WeChat.
Lay says her group posts and updates on WeChat every day and gets information from Portland area local government leaders and translates Northwest coronavirus news so they can quickly share with others. But Lay says although the community has been informed for months now, they are also very stressed out.
Earlier, we really concerned our families in China, so right now it's our turn.
The initial COVID-19 outbreak in China means Oregon's Chinese American community has been well aware of the virus for months. And now that it has spread to the rest of the world, Lay said families feel the roles have switched. Now families in China are concerned with their relatives in the United States and fear that people are not taking the situation seriously enough.
They really worry, and some people actually talk to me and they want to encourage people in our community. more people can wear masks.
Some people are also confused on what to do after losing their jobs because of COVID-19 and are having trouble finding resources online for support. Lay says her group is currently translating unemployment forms to help members in their community who need to fill them out. Joy Malumba is a supervisor with the African Family Holistic Health Organization. The organization serves over 200 families in the Portland metro area who speak Swahili, and he says his community is facing similar challenges. He says members also use social media and messaging apps like WhatsApp to share information. But he says some of the elders struggle to use new technology. That leaves Malumba with no choice but to make face-to-face contact to update them on the latest news. So he turned to YouTube to watch videos on how to be responsible in situations like a pandemic.
I realized it's like the knowledge and the skill set that I have right now is not equipped to handle this, but I should not be just the only person. It has to be a community effort.
Now Malumba's goal is to come up with a preparedness kit that will focus on health resources that Swahili speakers can use for themselves and for others in the community. For Here and Now, I'm Monica Samayoa.
On the Jersey Shore, residents of the Long Beach Island want to close the bridge that connects them to the mainland, except to year-long residents. There are now 10,000 signatures on a petition demanding that Massachusetts close the bridges to Cape Cod. Short-term rentals have been curtailed in Truckee, California, outside Reno, Nevada. And in Vinyl Haven, Maine, things got nasty when some residents felled a tree across a road to stop outsiders they thought might have COVID-19. Vacation destinations have had it. They're telling people fleeing COVID-19 for second homes or rentals, stay away. And now in Moab, Utah, the hip desert magnet for mountain bikers and kayakers, gateway to the Canyonlands and Arches National Parks, town officials have a request. Emily Niehaus is mayor. Mayor Niehaus, some of the flow to Moab was stopped when those parks were closed. Your governor asked residents to stay at home as COVID-19 was appearing up north at ski resorts. But you're now saying no rentals at all?
That's correct. In fact, it was 2 weeks ago when we started seeing the cases spike in ski resorts. As we were seeing the effect of the coronavirus on their communities, my health department came out with an order saying all lodging, so that's hotels, Airbnbs, camping, and dispersed camping, was shut down.
Wow. Some small towns are saying people were coming in and buying the limited resources that these towns had for winter residents. Are you seeing that as well as having a fear that people will bring in the COVID-19?
Absolutely. We're a city of 5,000 people, so we're very, very small. And people thought that their social distancing hack would be to come and camp in Moab. All of a sudden, the toilet paper was gone from our shelves and other kind of essential sundries were going missing. But then bigger and more importantly, when people come to Moab, they go mountain biking, they go rock climbing, they engage in risky, amazing recreation. But sometimes that risky recreation lands you in the hospital. And right now, our medical professionals are really wanting to stay focused on treating COVID-19 patients. And so a broken arm is kind of a monkey wrench in our system. So let's not be epic right now. We do not want to land in the hospital.
You still sound like the mayor of Moab. Let's not be epic right now. Well, we're seeing, too, that Greene County, which is north of New York City in the Catskills, is warning people, this is a large rural county. We don't have a hospital. You know, if something happens to you up here, if you get COVID-19, we can't care for you. You do have a hospital. Do you have any COVID-19 in your area?
We do have one confirmed case. We are celebrating the fact that we are not seeing a spike because we have been preventative, unlike the ski resorts that were, you know, forced to be reactive because it sort of happened during their season. COVID-19 spread kind of just as Moab was waking up from the winter. And so we've just been very lucky to flatten our curve as much as we can through our health department's order. But I just want to say, I get it. I get wanting to not stay in an apartment in a very urban area. I get why people are retreating to second homes. But if we think about the best care we can provide for ourselves, if we were to be infected by the coronavirus, the best care is going to be given at an individual's home community. That's where you will be the most safe, and we will be the most safe in our gateway communities. And when this is all over, please come on down, visit us in Moab.
Just a bit about the economics. We're reading about Dan Mick, owner of Dan Mick's Guided Tours. He says you can shoot a cannonball down Main Street there in Moab right now. There's just nobody there. And he could stand to lose $100,000. This is going to be a hit for Moab.
Absolutely. Businesses depend on March and April income because Moab is just amazing in the springtime. Most businesses say, all right, well, we can figure out how to get through 2 months, right? Maybe there's an SBA loan. Maybe with this new CARES package, there's the resource that they need as an individual or a business to get through 2 months. But for Moab, we depend on the revenue from our spring visitation. So it's a big hit. You know, right now we're in financial shock, and then we're probably going to find ourselves in financial spiral. Again, stay home now, but please come to Moab when this blows over.
How far are you willing to go? Is this something, I mean, are you going to arrest people? The historians talk about, I think it was Gunnison, Colorado, in the 1918 flu pandemic, which residents barred the town. They came out with shotguns, kept people out. They also kept the flu out. So how far are you going to go there in Utah? Not guns, but
well,
I mean,
we are still the wild, wild west out here. So I wouldn't put it past.
Will you arrest people? Yeah.
We are a valley. There is one entrance from the south and one entrance from the north. I'm not going to say that the shotguns won't come out because it is still the wild, wild west when things get real out here. But what we've been also trying to do is really message our story. Stay home and stay healthy, and we'll all get through this together, and then we'll see each other on the other side.
Well, you definitely can count me in. That's Mayor Emily Niehaus, Mayor of Moab, Utah. Mayor Niehaus, thanks so much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, she's not alone. The mayor of beautiful Traverse City in northern Michigan is telling Chicagoans, don't fly your private jets here. North Carolina's Outer Banks have barred non-residents. Red Horse Market in East Hampton says they've had to tell personal shoppers buying for summer folks, hey, you're taking too much. Don't hoard. Do you live in a destination city? Are you going through this? Maybe you have a second home and want to use it? Thoughts are welcome here in now.org.
The response to the coronavirus has varied widely in U.S. cities, but it's hard to say if things are going according to plan because many large cities keep their local pandemic response plans private. NPR's Meg Anderson reports.
We know there's a national plan for dealing with the pandemic. That comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And there are state plans. But individual cities need plans, too. In fact, those are especially important because a lot of the decisions that get made in a crisis are local ones. When to cancel events, when to close schools, bars, and restaurants. Plus, cities are often responsible for safeguarding the infrastructure that needs to keep running.
The classic example, I think, that gets talked about is electricity.
That's David Brett Major. He's an infectious disease physician at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. He says local plans can help lay out how a city government will tackle the ripple effects of a pandemic. Like, what happens if hospitals run out of masks or no longer have enough healthcare workers?
If I have a dollar for emergency response, and I give that dollar to somebody, can she then go ahead and actually hire somebody to help or buy the gear?
He says money isn't that useful if there isn't any more gear to buy in the first place. And he says even just writing down what could go wrong in a crisis helps lawmakers think through those scenarios. But if you wanted to see your own city's plans, you might have a tough time. NPR reached out to the public health departments that serve the 15 biggest cities in the country. We could confirm that only one of those cities had their most current pandemic plan posted publicly online. Some cities said their plans couldn't be made public for security reasons.
Overall, it seems to me that it's the exact opposite of what we need.
Alex Capron is a professor of law and medicine at the University of Southern California. He says these plans aren't just bureaucratic documents. They help lay a foundation of trust so the public will actually listen to key guidance, like social distancing.
And I think we have to trust the public if we're going to call on the public to be a huge part of the response.
But this isn't just about everyday decisions like washing your hands or staying at home. It can be about life and death. He says if we get to the point where hospitals are overwhelmed and have to choose who gets care and who doesn't,
the sooner public health officials acknowledge that there are going to be these choices and share how they're approaching them, the better.
Both the CDC and the World Health Organization stress the importance of clear communication during a pandemic. But take some of the biggest cities in Texas. Austin has a plan on its website from 2006 that instructed city officials to communicate using CD-ROMs. A spokesperson told NPR that actually the city's most recent plans are from 2011, but they aren't on its website. Houston said the plans on its website from 2006 were also out of date. After NPR asked about those plans, the city took them down. Then there's the matter of keeping pandemic plans fresh. Brett Major says ideally, local public health departments would update and practice response plans regularly.
They happen in fits and spurts when really they ought to be dynamic.
Only about half of the 15 biggest U.S. cities told NPR they've updated their plan in the past 2 years. A lack of funding can be a big reason for this.
Our attention follows the news cycle, and that is what happens with funding.
But he says now, whether or not we were ready is kind of a moot point. The emergency is already here. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
Let's bring in Bruce Feiler now, because we talk with him during uneasy times, and this would appear to be one. How to navigate it. Bruce is in the business of spiritual exploration, the best-selling author of books like Walking the Bible and The Council of Dads, which dealt with his own cancer diagnosis and the group of men he asked to father his daughters if he didn't make it. He made it, and his book was made into that new NBC show. And Bruce Feiler, we've reached you in New York, where the coronavirus is taking a terrible toll. So first, how are you and your family doing? What's the feeling there?
Well, we're doing okay. There are four of us hunkered down here in our home in Brooklyn. But I have to say the thing that is most poignant is the sound of the sirens outside our window 24 hours a day. It takes me back to 9/11. It's the only thing I can liken it to. And it's just a symbol that the pain is all around us. And it just takes us to some family is represented by that noise.
Right. You know, when you mentioned 9/11, my stomach just dropped, because I'll never forget the sirens then. But the terrible sadness then was that they were empty, because there was no one to bring. And here, as you said, you know, these are neighbors, people you might know. I mean, you know, a little prayer as each goes by, I'm sure. And, you know, what are you thinking now in this season for many of renewal, rebirth, on a religious plane, but also in the natural world? And then, bam, we can't go to houses of worship. We can't go, at least in big groups, to commune with nature. We're told we're going to be lucky if we can keep a death toll from COVID-19 to 100,000. What are you thinking about?
I'll tell you what I'm thinking about, Robin, is that pandemics like this, plagues, plights really of any kind, are history-altering events. They have been for thousands of years, going back to the Justinian plague 2,000 years ago. But they're also life-altering events. My term for this is these are life quakes, these forceful bursts of change in one's life that lead to periods of upheaval, transition, renewal. We're used to disruptors, and these are events that we can get through, but life quakes are events that change you. And I think that we all are coming to grips with the fact that this is going to change all of us. And I think most especially our identity. As you know, I've spent the last few years traveling across the country, interviewing people, collecting life stories of people who went through experiences like my cancer, life quakes of any kind. And I asked them, like, what is the big storyline in your life? Is it work or love, identity, body, beliefs? And this experience now, it affects all of those. It affects our work, our relationships, our identity. And to me, the word I keep coming back to is humility. Because if you haven't had any of your bedrock beliefs challenged by this, then really you're not paying attention. This is a virus of the body, but it's also a virus of the mind. I mean, think about it. If you're an activist liberal, well, guess what? Government has failed us on many levels. If you're a free market conservative, corporations have failed us. If you're a techno-utopian, technology has failed us. So to me, no matter where you look, there is something in this experience that shatters your beliefs. And that's why I think we should all approach it, especially in this season of meaning that we're entering, as a time to rethink our most basic values.
Well, it's interesting because I've been poking around and here I find Rabbi Shmuley Yankovitz, who's writing on the Jewish News of Northern California and saying something like that, that, you know, this is to some an existential crisis. Who do you believe in anymore? When so many institutions fail you, when your own body may fail you. And so what do you do with that? And also the fact that many people are at home, some working from home. Those are the lucky ones. Some not being paid. And, you know, talk about existential crisis, not knowing how they're going to support their children. So when the bottom seems to have been pulled out, what do you do?
I think we go back to ritual. That's what is grounding to us. So we kind of sacralize these moments when things change. So my thought would be, what ritual is most meaningful to your family? Is it ritual food? Is it ritual music? Is it church? Is it a Seder? Is it cleaning closets? Is it playing with puzzles? Whatever it might be. And look at what's gone viral on the internet in recent days. Group singing Beethoven's Ninth, people baking sourdough bread, right? New ways of celebrating birthdays. So here we are at the beginning of spring, right? Passover and Easter, there's no evidence that they happened at this time of year. They were put there by these traditions because we know this transition moment from winter to spring demands ritual. So find something that will give you structure in this unstructured time and turn to that. I think people will find it grounding.
Well, as the Rabbi Yankovitz says, and I'm again looking at some of his writings, embrace the sabbatical. Now, whether or not that's a term that you embrace in your own faith, but this idea, it's a break from work. It's, you know, maybe a frightening break from work. But is there a way that you can embrace it and make it sacred?
To me, this phase, like the first phase of these transitions, is a saying goodbye. The second phase is this kind of messy middle. And the first thing that it does involve is a period of shedding. And as he says, all great faith traditions have this, right? So for the Hindus, it's forest dwelling. And for, you know, the Buddha went off into the wilderness himself. The Abrahamic traditions have this kind of desert period, 40 days in the case of Jesus, 40 years in the case of the Israelites. And we go into this openness, and what do we have to do? We have to shed what came before. It might be comfort. It might be complacency, right? It may be habits. It may be who's my friend and who's my enemy, sort of old kind of patterns of conflict that we have that we need to reconsider now that we're inside the home. So I think a way to embrace the sabbatical, the openness, this period in the wilderness, is to identify something that maybe we didn't particularly like about ourselves and that say, oh, we don't have time to deal with that, and shed. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the first step of getting rid of the old and then opening the way for what's going to come next.
You know, the other thing that is the big difference between this time and so many other times where we've had to roll up our sleeves is that in those times, we got so much solace from like, okay, well, I can't do anything. You know, I'll go out and help somebody else. And you can't now in many ways. I mean, a lot of people are doing things online. There's great videos of people sending their Labrador retrievers carrying takeout food to a shut-in so that there's no virus spread, you know, door to door. But most of us can't go, you know, work in a shelter or help in a hospital emergency room. You can't because you have to stay indoors. So we're even being prohibited from doing the thing that has historically helped us get through these times.
One of the ways that we can contribute to the global healing is by turning to creativity, which is, I think, the next thing. You shed, but then there is sort of this act of creativity. And if you think about, again, the biblical stories, the great breakthroughs are when Abraham goes forth into the wilderness, when the Israelites go into the desert and have the Ten Commandments, right? When Israel gets kicked out of Jerusalem, they invent Shabbat, and the same thing happens with Christianity in those early vulnerable years. So again, now's a time to be creative, and that's a way to contribute to the global healing that we all need.
I just want to mention, too, that we still have our hands, and they may not be used for the, you know, kinds of things we want to do at a time like this, but they can applaud. And many cities are tomorrow night going to, you know, ask citizens to just go out and applaud for healthcare workers, and we can still do that.
And I think that the point that you make there, Robin, is that we all have to write the story of how we are getting through this and how we are going to get through this. Passover and Easter are the great narrative events of the sacred calendar. We are asked to relive those stories, re-experience those stories, and those stories can have two different endings. You know, people have looked at personal stories. You can have redemptive narratives or you can have contamination narratives. We know in the past that people have used the Black Death to blame Jews or lepers. We know with HIV, people were blamed, and the same with Ebola. So we have a choice now. How are we going to write this story? Is it going to be one of hatred and division and blame, or is it going to be one of unity and togetherness? And to me, that is the lesson of these great religious narratives as we come into this season, is that the great narratives, family, religious, personal, they find hope in the midst of despair. And we may not be there yet. We may be still in the early phases of this when we're saying goodbye and shedding and finding our creativity, but the story is not over. And we're going to get to write the ending. And the greatest ending to any story is to go back to where it began and say, once upon a time, is to start another story. We just have to imagine the better ending.
That's author Bruce Feiler. By the way, his new book, which is one of the many things delayed during this time, is called, appropriately, Life is in the Transitions. Bruce, we're adding a new chapter for you right now, so can't wait to see, because we are definitely in a transition right now. Bruce, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
More than 6.6 million people applied for unemployment insurance last week, shattering a record set in the previous week as the coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc on the economy. In anticipation of the economic turmoil, Congress passed that $2 trillion relief package. So what does it mean for the millions of Americans trying to access some of that money now? Let's bring in NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And when you hear that number, 6.6 million people, and you add that to the record-breaking numbers we saw last week, that means nearly 10 million people have filed new unemployment claims in the last 2 weeks. Put that in perspective for us. How widespread is the economic damage so far when it comes to job losses?
Jeremy, this is really unprecedented, both in the scope of the job losses and the speed at which they have occurred. That 6.6 million claims we saw just last week, that's about 10 times what we saw during the very worst week of the Great Recession back in 2009. And that was a recession that played out over a long period of time. This is really just a sudden stop. It's been super abrupt. One economist I spoke to said it's akin to what she saw along the Gulf Coast when Hurricane Katrina hit. But of course, this coronavirus is a hurricane that's casting a shadow over the whole country.
And when it comes to these unemployment applications, might we see unemployment claims continue to rise as the numbers start to reflect people who were unable to even get through on the websites in the first couple of weeks?
Yeah, last week may have marked the peak in first-time claims. We may not see another 6 million people filing a single week again, but we are certainly going to see continued growth in the total number of people who are out of work. Oxford Economics projects that the total could be 20 million before this pandemic is brought under control, and that the unemployment rate could soar to 12% or even higher. That would be higher than anything we've seen in the post-World War II period. During the Great Recession, unemployment topped out at about 10%. It was just under 11% during the severe 1982 recession. Other than that, you have to go back to the 1930s to see an unemployment rate in this anywhere near this. And the spike is all the more startling because, you know, we were matching a 50-year low in unemployment as recently as February, which I know seems like a long time ago now, but we're only talking about 5 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Scott, I want to ask you a couple of questions that people have been asking me, because I now know many people who have lost their income as a result of what's happened here. One of the questions is the extended unemployment insurance for freelancers and other workers who are not usually eligible. Can all self-employed people apply right now in this crisis for unemployment insurance?
Yes, they can. And this is a part of that $2 trillion package that Congress just approved. They both broaden the eligibility for unemployment insurance, so people like the self-employed and gig workers who traditionally have not been eligible can now apply for unemployment insurance. And Congress also sweetened the offer, so there's an extra $600 a week for workers during this pandemic, and those extra unemployment benefits will extend through the end of July.
And does that apply to all people who apply for unemployment benefits right now? Do they all get the extra money?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What about small business owners who are also worried about what they're going to do to keep their businesses afloat? They can get these loans from the federal government to stay afloat that become outright grants if they keep the workers on the payroll. So here's a question I've gotten, which is, if you're a small business owner trying to take advantage of that new program, should you keep all of your employees on the payroll and keep paying them, or lay off those workers so that they can then collect unemployment themselves?
Right. That's a calculation that small business owners are having to make. And even if you have previously laid off your workers, you are eligible to have that loan forgiven if you now rehire them and keep them on the payroll for 8 weeks. This small business loan program, it's about $350 billion in that relief package. It's supposed to start rolling out tomorrow. The Small Business Administration mm-hmm. has been working with banks around the country to make those loans available. They've put together a pretty simple form, and we'll be watching to see how that goes. It's obviously a lot of money that the government is trying to shovel out the door quickly, and the incentive is there to encourage employers to keep workers on the payroll. The idea of that is that if workers and businesses remain sort of attached, even if they're not working and the businesses aren't open right now, it will be easier and quicker when we get to the other side of this pandemic to turn the lights back on, open the doors, and go back into business. The fear is that the longer the shutdown lasts and the more workers drift away from their previous employers, then the harder it's going to be to get the economy up and running again when the time comes.
That is NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, I'm sure we're going to be talking to you a lot as this economic crisis continues along with the coronavirus crisis. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Robin, I'm sure you're getting questions, too, from people who they want to know what they're supposed
to
do right now.
Yeah, especially people who are in the, you know, young people in the gig economy. You know, what do they do? So we'll keep looking at this.
We will. News you can use is sometimes needed these days. This is Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young.